Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Real quickly, if you have knee pain or you know someone who has knee pain, we're actually releasing a 5 free-day little masterclass to understand and learn about the knee. It's all going to be in like an ebook PDF so that you can easily learn about it. Just drop your email in the link that we have below. So we're going to have that linked up in the show notes. So go find it. Pass it along to anyone you know who has knee pain or been struggling, because this is completely free. So it's just a resource to understand basic anatomy, just so you have an idea of what's happening with your knee and what you can really do about different diagnoses and different pains that you're having within your knee, so you don't have to feel so confused and out of touch. And it's completely free. So just drop your email and we're going to send out the links and the ebook starting on May 9th.
Our next guest, Dr. Shauna Shapiro, is a PhD, best-selling author, clinical psychologist, and internationally recognized expert in mindfulness and self-compassion. She's a professor at Santa Clara University and has published over 150 papers and 3 critically acclaimed books translated into 16 different languages. Shauna has presented her research to the King of Thailand, the Danish government, Bhutan's Gross National Happiness Summit, and the World Council for Psychotherapy, as well as to Fortune 100 companies, including Google, Cisco Systems, and LinkedIn. Her work has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Mashable, Wired, USA Today, Dr. Oz, The Huffington Post, and The American Psychologist. Shauna is a summa cum laude graduate of Duke University and a fellow of the Mind and Life Institute, co-founded by the Dalai Lama. Her TEDx talk, The Power of Mindfulness, has been viewed over 2.5 million times. Super excited for the interview. Dr. Shapiro gives so many little tangible takeaways that you can start today to start figuring out how mindfulness fits better in your life and can really impact your health. Dr. Shapiro, thank you so much for making the time to be with us this morning. This is an interview that I've been getting really excited for because I don't even know how I found. I think it was somebody on Instagram recommended me, like, hey, you should read this book, Good Morning, I Love You, and ended up picking it up. And then a friend of mine, Justin Michael Williams, said, oh, hey, that's a friend of mine, like, you should reach out to her. And here we are.
Here we are. Well, I'm delighted. I'm really honored to be here with you both.
Well, I think it's just incredible. I'm always fascinated by the want to go down, you know, more of the research route behind mindfulness and compassion and the work that you do. Can you tell me a little bit more about why going into research on this stuff is important? I know there's a lot of people that, you know, you just take courses or you just go to meditations and you fall into this kind of stuff. Was that your journey? How did you go into kind of the research route?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I've been actually doing the research since 1998. So I was thinking it's like over 25 years, my first publication. And what happened was when I was 17 years old, I had spinal fusion surgery. So I had a metal rod put in my spine. I had scoliosis that had progressed so rapidly that my orthopedic surgeon said it was going to puncture my lungs if we didn't operate. So I had this kind of very radical shift, you know, as a teenager. I went from, you know, captain of the volleyball team and had just signed to play at Duke University to lying in a hospital bed, unable to walk. And I really, you know, didn't have the tools to cope at the time. I was in a lot of physical pain, of course, but it was the mental anguish that really got to me. This fear of, you know, would I ever be pain-free again? Would I ever walk normally again? You know, and also regrets about my past. And so luckily I found mindfulness during that time and it really supported me through my recovery. And once I was healthy enough, I decided to go to Thailand to study mindfulness, to really experience meditation, which I hadn't really done any of before. And what I experienced while I was in Thailand was such a profound sense of calm and peace, but also this comfort in my body that I hadn't had since the surgery. And my whole family is academics and professors. And so when I came back to the United States, I said, I want to study this scientifically. Like, I want to understand what just happened because it was so profound. And I'm a scientist. I don't necessarily believe in magic. And so I started my PhD and eventually became a professor and have literally spent the last 25 years studying mindfulness.
Wow.
That's amazing. And again, I love how you kind of address that. I don't believe in magic. And I think that so many people kind of look at mindfulness and meditation and see it as like this voodoo science. But again, this is where I appreciate people like yourself and who are doing the research in the area to show like these are the physiologic changes that we can see and how profound they can be on our health. One thing that I think a lot of people struggle with is when they want to go into a mindful practice of sorts, they feel like they're bad at it. Or they feel like, man, I can't do this. I've sat here for 3 minutes and I've already thought about 20 different things that I have to do throughout the day. And it almost promotes this feeling of failure. Like I am failing mindfulness right now. What would you say to that type of person?
I would say you're very normal. And in fact, that's what 99.9% of people that I work with say. And that was my experience. You know, when I first went to the monastery, I breezed through it a minute ago because I wanted to be expedient. But it wasn't easy in the beginning. And in fact, I vividly recall, you know, I was at the monastery for about 4 days in silence and really struggling with my mind wandering all over the place and frustrated and impatient with myself. And this monk arrived who spoke English. And as I shared with him my struggles, he looked at me and he said, "Oh dear, you're not practicing mindfulness. You're practicing impatience, frustration, judgment." And then he said 5 words that I'll never forget. He said, "What you practice grows stronger." And we know this now with neuroplasticity. Our repeated thoughts, emotions, behaviors, they shape our brain. So if we're meditating with judgment, if we're sitting there judging ourselves and thinking more bad, all we're doing is growing neural pathways of judgment. The key to meditation and really the key to mindfulness is this attitude of kindness and curiosity. That instead of judging ourselves, we notice, oh, my mind's wandering. And in fact, what the research shows is your mind wanders on average 47% of the time. So that's about half of your life that your mind is going to be wandering. And that's everyone. It's not just you. And so there's this real sense of compassion for ourselves. That's just the condition of the mind. And also a sense of curiosity, like, wow, how am I even functioning in this life? It's kind of a miracle. And being interested in kind of where does my mind go? And as you start to wake up, life starts to become a bit more vivid, a bit clearer. It's like you wake up out of a fog. You're not on automatic pilot anymore.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all, it makes so much sense in terms of being able to add this in, getting clearer, feeling less heavy and judgmental, I would say, throughout life. But I'm curious to go back real quick to about your journey into finding mindfulness. So you had this spinal surgery and at such a young age too. Were you told to kind of try this mindfulness thing because of pain you were experiencing?
Yeah. So that was exactly it. So what happened was, I mean, it's amazing to think back, but I got out of the hospital. I was in a hospital bed for 6 months, but they sent me home. I think it was maybe 2 weeks after the surgery. And I got home. There was no physical therapy. There was no rehabilitation. There was no psych evaluation. There was no support whatsoever back then.
Wow.
And I remember I was just lying in my hospital bed every day, you know, and I was in high school. I didn't get to obviously graduate or I graduated, but I never got to go to high school again. I never went to my high school prom. I never did any of that. And I was just lying in this bed. And luckily my dad, who I'd had kind of a fraught relationship with in high school, but he gave me a book on mindfulness. And the very first sentence in the book was, "Whatever has happened to you, it's already happened. The only question that matters is now what?" And all of a sudden I realized like, oh, there's a pathway out of this. I'm not stuck forever and ever. And I kind of voraciously read this book. It was a beautiful book by Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, "Wherever You Go, There You Are." And I kind of went through this book and started in my own mind trying to figure out how to practice mindfulness, which at the time I kind of understood it as being present. And so I started just when my thoughts would race into the future, I would bring them back to the present, and I would notice the, you know, ocean breeze coming through the window, or I would notice, you know, the soup my mom had made me. And as my, you know, there was kind of a path forward. And I feel really lucky because I, you know, I think probably most 17-year-olds, I don't know, something just, it was, I said, I don't believe in magic, but there's a moment of magic where it was just kind of the universe offered me this gift and somehow is able to receive it.
Mm, that is so cool.
I want to lean into pain just a little bit more too, because this is just, I mean, I know there's so much to talk to you on this whole topic that we might not be able to fit it into one episode, right? But so many people who listen to our podcast are stuck in this repetitive cycle of pain. Using mindfulness, like how do we start to break that cycle of the pain that we're experiencing? And how do you recommend that people use your tools and your practice in order to start to break that cycle that we feel?
Absolutely. It's such an important question. And I want to say it's not an easy one. So I'm going to try to be very nuanced in my answer.
Yeah.
The first thing I think to understand, and you all are pain experts as well, but I think the first thing to understand is that there's a difference between pain and suffering. Mm. That from a mindfulness lens, pain is part of life. That pain is kind of a constant, that there's always going to be pain, whether it be our physical pain or you know, limitations in our body or emotional pain or just traffic or things not going well. There's going to be things in life that are painful. But how much we resist or fight against them determines how much we suffer. So the idea is that suffering is optional. And so from a mindfulness lens, there's this wonderful equation by Shinzen Young, and he says, suffering equals pain times resistance. S equals P times R. So if we have, let's say, a headache and it's 10 units of pain, but we really start resisting it. Oh my God, I can't believe I have this headache and I'm in the middle of a podcast, the worst timing. And why didn't I drink more water? And, you know, we kind of were resisting and adding it. Oh my God, is it always going to be like this? And how will I survive tomorrow? And how will I handle the meeting after this? That's resisting the pain. And so let's say we have a 10 unit headache and we have maybe 100 units of resistance. Right. All of a sudden we have 10,000 units of suffering over just a 10 unit headache. And so the idea with mindfulness is not to pretend the headache isn't there. It's still there. It's still 10 units, but to bring our kind attention to the pain and just simply notice throbbing, tension, heat, coolness without adding that layer of resistance. So we thereby decrease our suffering, even though the pain may stay constant. And what's fascinating about the research, because mindfulness and mindfulness-based stress reduction was developed for patients with chronic pain. And there's now, you know, 3 decades of research showing that for the majority of patients, it actually decreased their pain levels. But for those where it didn't decrease their pain, which is what I was just talking about, you have this 10-unit headache, it's there. It increased their ability to kind of function in daily life. It increased their ability to pick up their children or go back to work because their relationship to the pain had shifted.
That is so, so beautiful. I love that way that it was explained. Thank you.
Yeah, I love that little equation you gave that our suffering equals the pain times the resistance. And I think you mentioned, you know, Jen and I deal a lot with and educate a lot on pain, and often we'll go the route of breath work and how when you come to your breath, you can shift a lot of things in your mind. And, you know, not to get too sciencey, but that's where we see all of these physiologic changes in our autonomic nervous system and in how we are downregulating different stress hormones. Like, can you speak to, do we see some of those similar shifts in the stress hormones that our brain is releasing or shifts in our autonomic nervous system when we're practicing mindfulness?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the research on the physiological benefits of mindfulness is quite robust. And I think what mindfulness does, I think one of the most helpful things it does is it starts to kind of downregulate our autonomic nervous system and help us get into a state of homeostasis. And I think it creates this really important pause between whatever the trigger or stimulus was and our response. And I think in that pause, in that space is really where our freedom and our, you know, possibility lie. And so what mindfulness does is kind of takes us out of the grip of fight or flight and puts us back into conscious choice. And what's interesting is the word mindfulness means to see clearly. So all we're trying to do is see clearly what's happening in the present moment so that we can respond effectively. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons that it is able to help us in these kind of very painful or very stressful situations. Now, of course, there's also lots of research showing, you know, that mindfulness does reduce inflammation, that it improves our sleep, that it improves our immune functioning. It even protects the ends of our DNA strands that keep us kind of youthful and slow down aging. These are the telomeres. It actually increases the enzyme telomerase so that it helps lengthen our telomeres. So there's lots of kind of physiological benefits, but I think from more of a meta perspective, it's this space between our reactivity that where mindfulness, where the power really lies.
Mm-hmm. And how do we start to tap into being able to achieve that level of mindfulness where we're getting these physiological changes that that are happening over time? Is it meditating for an hour? Is it doing like how do right. we even start?
So this, great. This is the question I always get. Everyone always asks, well, how many minutes a day do I have to practice to get the benefits? So my response is twofold. One is what you practice grows stronger. So there definitely is research showing that the more you practice, the more benefits you receive. However, there has been numerous studies showing that between 7 to 12 minutes per day on average is where you start to see changes in the brain, changes in the immune functioning, changes in overall well-being. And so you asked, how do you start? When I'm working with my clients or my students, I always kind of have them set ridiculously unambitious goals, right? So we don't start with an hour a day. We start with maybe even 2 minutes a day, because the key is to be able to trust yourself, trust your commitment, and to create a new pattern. It doesn't have to be a huge new pattern. In fact, little micro changes lead to big outcomes. And so for anyone listening who wants to begin a meditation practice, there are three key things. One is to set a realistic goal, very, very, that you know you can meet. The second is to schedule it. This does not just happen. It's like exercise. You know, if you want to go play tennis, you need to schedule it and you need to get a racket and, you know, be prepared. So you need to set a goal. You need to schedule it. And then the third thing is to set an intention. And we haven't talked a lot about this yet, but intention is really at the heart of mindfulness. And intention is kind of your aspiration, your goal. It's what you value. And from a mindfulness lens, intention is, why are you paying attention, right? Everyone always talks about mindfulness as being present, paying attention, but it's really your intention and your attention. And so your intention is, why is this important? And so if you reflect right now, why would I want to start a practice? Maybe it is to address pain, or maybe it is to have more clarity in your life, or even more joy. That's a often underdeveloped part of mindfulness, is that it often leads to more joy, that we start to be present for the sometimes overlooked moments in our life that are quite joyful and quite pleasant. So what I would say for people starting is these three things: of set a goal, find a place, set a goal in terms of a number of minutes. And then your intention is kind of that bigger goal of what motivates you. I like to say it's kind of your intention sets the compass of your heart.
Mm. No, I love that. And what does this look like? Does it need to look a certain way? Do they need to be in an empty room, no distractions, music playing, legs crossed? Like,
okay, great. So this is good. So, and I haven't done this yet either, but I want to differentiate between mindfulness and meditation, first off.
Perfect.
So mindfulness is a way of being that can be practiced in any moment, in any position. So I'm a mom and we now have 4 teenage kids. So it's not always quiet and there isn't always a room that doesn't have someone in it. And so part of the practice is bringing this presence, this intention, this kindness with you in every situation as best you can with a lot of self-compassion. Meditation is the actual exercise or practice that you do to develop your mindfulness. So meditation is like going to the gym and working out. And so for learning a meditation practice, and there's hundreds and hundreds, it is helpful to be in a relatively quiet place, although we cannot always control that. And it's helpful, as I said, to set a specific time. You don't have to be in a yogic meditative posture. What's most important is that you're relatively still and that you're supported. So some of my patients who have, you know, severe limitations in their body, they lie down for meditation. That's perfectly fine. Some people stand. Some people sit in traditional yogic posture. Some people sit in a chair. And the key, again, is to be relatively still, relatively comfortable, yet alert. And that's one of the unique dimensions of meditation, is that it's this altered state of consciousness where you're physiologically at ease, and yet your mind is like laser-like, super sharp, which, you know, normally don't go together. And so we cultivate it.
Now, how do we cultivate this practice if there's a lot of self-shame or self-talk coming along with it? Oh my gosh, I can't shut off my mind. Oh, I missed yesterday. I'm failing. I'm like, how do we start to build this practice if we still have this inner critic really speaking loudly?
Beautiful. And so I'm going to amend my last comment that said there are three important things to begin a meditation practice, and we're going to make it four. And the fourth one is to begin again. The fourth one, it really embodies this attitude of compassion for ourselves, really understanding that this is a practice. It's not about perfect. And the self-talk, I think, is the single most kind of deleterious thing for our health. This negative self-talk where we are shaming ourselves, where we are judging ourselves, where we're beating ourselves up. And we somehow have this mistaken belief that if we push harder or we judge ourselves, that will improve. And so what I want everyone to know is that doesn't work. That shaming ourselves actually shuts down the learning centers of the brain. So it keeps us stuck in repeating the same patterns that we want to change. Mm. So the key, and it's kind of surprising, but the very simple key is to start to be kind to yourself, to speak to yourself as if you're on your own team, which why wouldn't you be? And people often roll their eyes when I talk about self-compassion and kindness. They're like, well, you don't understand. I actually want to change. If I'm kind to myself, I'm just going to be a couch potato, you know, and sitting on the couch, never exercise, never take care of myself. And that's actually not true. What the research shows and has shown again and again over the decades is that self-compassion, being kind to yourself, actually increases people's ability to exercise, to stick to a diet plan, to take care of themselves. And it actually shows that you're better in relationships. A lot of times people feel like they're going to be selfish if they take time for themselves. People who score high on self-compassion, they're rated as more generous and more compassionate in their relationships with family and friends. So this attitude of kindness, which is one of the core attitudes of mindfulness, it's really key to development and change. And one of the reasons why, just to give you the scientific lens, is that, as I said, when we shame ourselves, we go into a fight or flight response that shuts down our learning centers. When we support ourselves, when we're kind to ourselves, it releases both oxytocin, which is this hormone that promotes safety and soothing. And it also releases dopamine, which is the neuromodulator of motivation and learning. So you put yourself in this exquisitely perfect environment for learning, growth, and change.
Mm, I think that's so important to keep in mind, and how that self-kindness and compassion is that beginning again. And we get to begin again every time we sit down and think into ourselves a little bit. And I wanted to, you mentioned neuroplasticity early on, and I think it's this super, super important thing that I know you talk about a lot, that our human being and brain was equipped with this ability to always be changing. And I feel like that's also something difficult for people to think, like if they are someone who's been going through real severe PTSD, or, you know, just has a lot of chronic depression and they've been thinking a certain way for a long, long time. Is it per se more difficult for somebody to change or change the way their brain operates if they have been having these types of thoughts or for a long time versus somebody who might start early on?
So it's a great question. I want to talk a little bit about neuroplasticity because I think it's often misunderstood. So first, neuroplasticity, I think, is one of the most hopeful messages that has been discovered in science in the last 400 years. It's incredible, right? We have the capacity to change the architecture of our brain, not just early in life, but throughout our entire lifespan. So that's extraordinary. And yet, I think people often misunderstand it and they say, oh, great, I can just change, which is going to lead to your question. That after age 25, not just right on your birthday, but, you know, somewhere around there, that it kind of slows down. That when we are age 0 to 25, we can learn almost anything. And our brain is just receiving. It's just passively learning. We don't actually have to engage it. After age 25, you have to engage neuroplasticity. In fact, no one over the age of 25 can change unless they volitionally want to. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So you can't change someone else's brain. They have to want to. And that's the first step, this intention, this motivation, this engagement. So the key to neuroplasticity, to engaging neuroplasticity, is first just knowing what you want to change, that intention and that real purity of intention. And second is practice, really being alert and focused and engaging new pathways. So for someone who has, let's say, a history of depression, they have practiced a lot of these kind of maybe unhealthy pathways. And so it will take a bit more work, but it's possible. And I think that is what is so hopeful for me as a clinical psychologist who works with many people who are depressed, that yes, it's going to take work, but it's possible, and that we can do this work together. And, you know, the reason actually that I wrote my new journal is because I'd published my book and I had so many people writing me and saying, this was so helpful, but now what? And what I realized as a scientist is that in order to change, you have to practice. You have to practice in a repeated, consistent way. And so I developed this journal with specific practices that you can do every morning and every evening in just 5 minutes that can literally help to rewire your brain. And so what I would say in the short to answer your question is, it's absolutely possible.
And how and why morning and night? Is there a specific reason that those two instances are most important?
Yes. Okay. So I'm glad you asked this. So again, I'm a scientist and I'm a professor. So everything in my book, I wish I could say it was just all whimsical and creative, but it's all based in science. And the reason that I chose morning and evening is because new research, and this is only 2 years old. If you had asked me 4 years ago, I would have said, practice whenever you can. But what new research shows is that the morning and the evening, your mood in the morning and the evening, are the best predictors of your overall health and well-being. They predict the length of your telomeres, which I had mentioned before, these little strands at the end of the DNA. They predict the health of your mitochondria, which are the body's energy battery. So morning and evening is a really important time to protect the mind. And yet typically, what do? We wake up in the morning, we grab our phone, we're like, oh my God, I have all these things to do. Or we get on social media and we're like, oh my God, oh my God. And the same is true in the evening. And so I created the journal to give people specific practices that would protect them from maybe unhealthy things they do morning and evening and help them cultivate and build these resources. And so what's interesting is this science maps on perfectly to all the wisdom traditions that suggest that you should practice morning and evening.
I think that's so important. And I'm even reflecting a little bit on myself because, I mean, morning, I always feel great and I feel like morning's my time and I have my practices that keep me balanced. And evening or night might not, I wouldn't say the same thing. I tend to get a little grouchier at night. So maybe when I get your journal, when it finally comes out, I guess we're recording this before it launches, but the journal, which I want to dive a little more into next, is out and we have a link to it down in our show notes for anybody who might be interested. It's called Good Morning, I Love You.
That's what it's called. Good morning, I love you. Love a guided it. Journal for calm, clarity, and joy.
Love it. Well, once I get it, I'm going to be looking more into some of the practices I can do in the evening, because I think that would be very, very helpful to me. And now as I learn my overall health, if I can improve my my mood a little bit later on. But speaking of the journal and just the book in general, like I mentioned at the beginning, I read your book, Good Morning, I Love You. And even when I started it, I was a little, I don't want to say cynical, it's probably not the right word, but I'm just like, Good Morning, I Love You. Okay, this sounds a little flu, but whatever, I'm going to go for it. And I love when you tell the story about where that title kind of comes from. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. So first of all, I have to say, I am terrible at marketing. And, you know, I've been a professor my entire life. I mean, I became a professor when I was 28 and never had another job. And so when my publisher said, you know, what do you want the title to be? And I said, Good Morning, I Love You. They said, oh God, no, you're a scientist. You have 25 years of experience. Like, we want to showcase that. And I said, you know, I have to call it this because this practice is what changed my life. And if this helps it reach more people by focusing on that. So they let me, although I will say that in the UK, apparently Good Morning, I Love You doesn't translate into British. I'm kidding, but they titled it Rewire Your Mind. So if anyone doesn't like the title, or you feel like your husband or spouse or someone is going to appreciate that better, you can just order it on the UK Amazon under Rewire Your Mind. Exact same book, not a word was changed. But so here's the story behind it. When I was, gosh, some years ago, I was going through a pretty difficult divorce. Our son was 3 years old, and I was in a very challenging state, and I would wake up every morning with this kind of pit in my stomach. Like, I've failed. I've ruined not only my life, but our son's life. And I really couldn't let go of the shame. And my teacher suggested I start practicing self-compassion. And she said, I want you to say, I love you, Shauna, every day. And I was like, no way. It just felt so contrived and inauthentic and so far from what I was actually feeling. And so she recognized that, and she said, well, how about just saying good morning, Shauna? Just offering yourself a little bit of kindness instead of berating yourself every morning. And so the next morning I woke up, I took a breath, and I said, good morning, Shauna. And it was kind of nice, right? Instead of that avalanche of shame, there was just this spark of kindness. And I continued to practice. And after a few months, it was my birthday, and it was my first birthday ever in my life, I think, that I was absolutely alone. My son was with his father, and I remember waking up, and I put my hand on my heart. For those of you that want to know, that releases oxytocin, which is good for you. So I put my hand on my heart, and I took a breath, kind of preparing to do the Good Morning Shauna practice. And then this image of my grandmother, my Nana, who raised me and who I love, she just kind of came to me, and she had passed away a few years before. And I had this image of her. And before I knew it, I said, good morning, I love you, Shauna. Happy birthday. And it was as if this dam around my heart burst, and I felt her love just pouring in, and my mother's love and my own self-love. And, you know, I wish I could tell you every day since then has been this miracle of self-love and I've never felt shame again. And that's not true. But what is true is this pathway of kindness was established, and I've been practicing every day since. And what's been amazing is the way it's evolved. That, you know, first I was just saying it to myself and to my son every morning. And then I started kind of sending it to, you know, my friends who I missed, or someone who was having a hard time, or maybe if there was, you know, birds chirping outside, I would just say, good morning, I love you, to them. And it became this kind of evolving practice where my morning was filled with this sense of kindness and connection, both towards myself and toward others. And as I began teaching this practice, the response was so surprising. And that's when I really began to realize that this idea of learning how to love ourselves is so foreign and so needed. And even though it feels awkward and uncomfortable, its power is tremendous.
That is such an incredible story. I feel like I get chills as I'm listening, and can kind of reflect on a similar journey that I had for myself as well. That felt very, very foreign. And I'm sure a lot of people listening, you know, have that same experience of not even being able to comprehend saying those words to themselves. And and so developing a practice, I think sometimes too, what might hold people back is the thought of like, but I get up in the morning and it's all I can do is get up, shower, get ready, get my coffee, go out the door. Like I don't have time. What do you say for people who just feel so overwhelmed with life that they don't feel like they have time to add this stuff in?
Yes. And that's why I love this practice, is this practice takes 10 seconds in the morning while you're lying in bed before I even open my eyes or get out of bed, no matter what is going on in my life. I put my hand on my heart and I say, good morning. I love you, Shauna. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you the truth. Some days I feel nothing. And some days it feels kind of hokey, right? Some days my husband teases me and he's like, oh, there she goes. But it's a practice that I'm committed to for my life. And I know that even just that moment of kindness will set the trajectory of my day in a different direction. And as I've continued to practice, there have been real changes. And this, you know, I the other day, actually, I dropped a chair on my foot and I was like, oh, ow. And then I was like, oh, sweetheart. You know, instead of saying you stupid moron, I was like, oh, ouch, that hurt. And then I was like, oh my God, I was just so nice to myself. And it was like these practices, they really do change your brain and they change the way you relate to yourself and to life.
Nah, I think that's fantastic. And I think it was a little earlier you were talking about the ridiculously minimal goal or like that you can set for yourself. And really that 10 seconds just to say, put your hand on your heart and say, good morning, or good morning, I love you. I mean, it was similar for me where it initially going in, it felt like it was going to be hokey or, you know, disingenuous. And it really, like, you do it and you get this little smile on your face and it's just like, okay, that felt pretty good. And I think it can really be that way for a lot of people to start anew on a morning and do it slightly differently than they normally do. And it'll only take you 10 extra seconds. So I would definitely recommend that to anybody. We have the link to the journal that is now out down in the show notes.
And the book.
And the book. Yes, I would recommend anybody checking those out. Shauna, is there anywhere else you'd want people to go to learn more about you or learn more from you?
Thank you both so much. So my website, drshaunashapiro.com, has a lot of free meditations and articles and videos. I'm also on Instagram at drshaunashapiro.
Amazing. This has been so incredible. And as I said in the beginning, I know there's so many more areas that we could dive into in terms of the science and hopefully getting people to really catch on and be excited to start something, just something little. So I know that your journal is going to be a huge help in doing that. So thank you for bringing that out for people and just bringing the research to something that's can be so applicable. And I think that's really what's incredible about what you do. So we just really appreciate your knowledge and your time and being here.
Thank you both so much.
Such an incredible episode with Dr. Shapiro to really understand the science and research behind mindfulness. Now, if you are in the Gen Health plans, particularly in our pain plan, so think of the knee plan, the low back plan, the neck plan, I do sprinkle in some mindset tools at the end of each week in order to continue this process of understanding how our mind connection into the body can impact chronic pain. So if you haven't tried one of the plans yet and you notice that you have these pains that continue to pop up, please just type in gen.health to your web browser, not .com, not anything else, or click the link that we have in the show notes and go check out Gen Health. Start a plan for free and see what this can feel like in your body when you continue to bring in these tools to really help and support your body relieving the pain. And of course, we hope to see you back on another episode of the Optimal Body Podcast.